So tonight we start a class on the Law of Moses. Calm down. I know that this is your favorite biblical subject. And to celebrate that, we're going to start off in everyone's favorite biblical book, Leviticus. So I'll get it going. And I know you have your favorite Leviticus passage. But this is just a sampling of Leviticus. I'm going to start us off with Leviticus 1, 8, and 9. And Aaron's sons, the priests, shall arrange the pieces, the head, and the fat on the wood that is on the fire on the altar. But its entrails and its legs he shall wash with water, and the priest shall burn all of it on the altar as a burnt offering, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to God. Down in verse 14. If his offering to the Lord is a burnt offering of birds, then he shall bring his offering of turtle doves or pigeons, and the priest shall bring it to the altar and wring off its head and burn it on the altar. Its blood shall be drained out on the side of the altar. Well, we're off to a great start. Leviticus 17:10, Vince.
And any man from the house of Israel or from the alien who sojourns among them any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from among his people.
All right, don't eat blood. Lori, 19, 9 to 10. It's about farming. So relevant to all of us.
When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge. Neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. And you shall not strip your vineyard bare. Neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God.
All right, of course, what Bible character do we think of when you hear that about leaving the extra?
Ruth.
Ruth, yes. And then everyone's favorite Israelite holiday, Rachel 23:23-24.
Again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, on the first of the month, you shall have a rest, a reminder by blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation.
I mean, this sounds like one that's designed for 10-year-olds. The feast of blowing trumpets. Just making noise, okay? Andrew's going to read 23-25, please.
The land shall not be sold permanently. For the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the land of your possession, you shall grant redemption of the land. If one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, and if his redeeming relatives comes to redeem it, then he may redeem what his brother has sold.
All right, what kind of society is this? That you can't sell your land, okay? Boy, is that a wide distribution there. Yeah.
Well, it prevented, I think the thing was to prevent homelessness.
Yeah, there's a lot of practical benefits, and that's part of it, so that people don't become destitute. Exactly right. So you saw that splattering of different things there. You just flip page to page in the book of Leviticus, and you'll keep finding just a wide variety of things. So what do you think about this? How do you feel about, for the next 12 weeks, studying the Law of Moses on Wednesdays after you've had a long day? How do you feel about that?
Great stuff.
Okay, Vince, that's just your attitude about everything. Hard to live with, isn't he, Kathy? He really is. That's why we love you, brother.
As long as you don't have to go sit at tables and draw.
Okay, that's Rick's deal. It's Rick. If I can get in that soft seat and stay, that is Rick's objective on Wednesday night.
Don't put a pile of blood in front of
me. And don't worry. Frank's thinking, I know this guy, and he might do that.
The Indians kill a beef.
And then drink
and
it.
And drink the
blood. Native Americans did that. Yeah. Okay. We're not going to have any of those demonstrations. I can assure you that. I know I might pull something out like that, but no, we're not going to do that. Why do we have, or I'm trying to fish this reaction out of you, why do we have this kind of reaction to the Law of Moses?
Because it's not normal for us.
Because it's what?
It's not normal for us. It's not a normal thing anymore.
Some of these things don't connect to us, right? They're not part of our world even.
It's complicated.
It's what?
Complicated.
Very complicated, Joe.
I've heard of forgiving debts every 50 years. I'm 49 years.
Right. I mean, there are some unique, shall we say, unique things? We can put it that way. Okay. Jesse, what were you going to say?
Yeah, it's like sitting down and reading a law book. This is the law of an entire country in one book.
You ever go into a lawyer's office, you see all those books? They don't sit and open up page one and read through those books. Okay? Sorry. I just thought we had one. Sorry.
They don't do that. Okay? Or it's like pulling out the manual for Buncombe County regarding restaurants and health safety guidelines, which is not far from some of the things that are happening in the book of Leviticus about food handling, okay? So I think most of us, it's in there, and we know that it's there, and it's got to be important, but most of us, this is not an intriguing part of the Bible, and it's a little, it's challenging to us, and on top of that, as New Testament Christians, how do we tend to look at the Old Testament? I mean, sorry, the law of Moses in the Old Testament. It served its purpose. It's done. Okay? What else? How do we see it as a law system, as Christians?
Well, it was like a tutor.
That's right. Temporary. Okay? Well, let's look at a couple passages. Turn with me to the book of Hebrews. I think our study of Hebrews late last year probably sets us up very well for this. It's important to get a couple of terms here in front of us that are distinct terms but are interconnected and almost can't be separated. Hebrews chapter 9. This is, of course, the Hebrew writer trying to persuade these Jewish Christians not to go back in Judaism and keep their faith in Christ. And I got Rebecca on my mind because of Genesis. Becca, read Hebrews 9:19-20, please. 9:19-20.
For when Moses had spoken every precept to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and goats with water, scarlet wool, and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God hath commanded you."
All right. I want you to note two terms here. The second one first, and that is this blood ceremony. Moses called it the blood of what?
Covenant.
Blood of the covenant. Matter of fact, that sort of is reminiscent of what quote in the New Testament?
Jesus
the night he was betrayed when he taught about the Lord's Supper. This is the cup of the blood of my covenant. Yes. But right before that, this text talks about how that Moses had given them the law. So, y'all hang on to yourselves. I'm not using PowerPoint for the next 3 months either. I know. That's what's gotten into me. I don't know. Okay. No blood, no PowerPoint, either one. Okay. But these two terms, covenant and law, they're distinct, but they're very connected. Covenant is a binding agreement between two parties. An agreement that has consequences and blessings. Law is what is given within that covenant that provides the guidelines and the conditions. I want you to consider how that many, many relationships have a covenant element and a law element. I want you to think about it. Like if you take a job, they've committed to pay you so much money and you've committed to go and fill that role at that company. But after you get there, what must you learn? Just all the different things, aspects of the job. School. Somebody enrolls in college and they're going to get XYZ degree and they have to take this course and they walk in. This is the agreement they've made to take this course. The professor's been selected to teach that course. But then you got to hear what the assignments are that will guide you in that relationship. Even marriage has covenant law. Obviously, marriage is a commitment to one another, and that's a covenant commitment. But within that marriage, a couple sort of works out the law. Who takes out the garbage? Who's going to be taking care of the meals and the laundry? Who's going to pay the bills? Those kinds of things, you sort of work out who's going to do what, and if people don't do the things they're supposed to do, then there are problems. And so the idea that there is a covenant relationship, two parties have committed to each other, and that along with that is law to be a guideline, they go hand in hand. That's just a common kind of experience. And that's what happens after the Israelites leave Egypt and they come to Sinai. They make a covenant with God, and then he gives them a law to live by. And while we're there, Hebrews chapter 8, glance back over previous chapter. What does he say about this covenant in verse 7? Hebrews 8, verse 7. Said if that covenant had been faultless or flawless, which implies what?
It was
faulty or flawed. Okay, I want to think about this. The first covenant was flawed or faulty. Who gave that covenant?
God.
So to understand its fault or flaw, we've got to understand a lot of things, because God does not give flawed things. He doesn't give faulty things. And then in the same chapter, look down in verse 13. What does it say about the old covenant, which would also include the law? It's obsolete. So again, as New Testament Christians, it's really easy for us just to take the law of Moses, put it in a box, tape it up, and put it on the highest shelf in the back of the closet. From a biblical standpoint, as a Bible student and just as a Christian looking at things, that it's regulated to the past because after all, there was something wrong with it. After all, it's complicated. After all, it's not. There are a lot of things not relevant to me. And when we were looking at reading the narratives of the Old Testament this year, I really wanted us to do this study. And actually, I've never done a study like this before. I've never taught a class like this before. And what's interesting is I asked two guys, two preachers, one my age and one older. I said, and these guys are really great Bible students and really good teachers. And I said, do you have any good recommendations on a book about how the Christian should view the law of Moses? They both went blank. Neither one of them have given me a recommendation. Now they may, but they went blank on me and they said, I'll get back to you. They haven't gotten back to me. And so I just think this is a really untapped thing. How a Christian should look at the law of Moses. I'm talking about all the law of Moses, not just there's a covenant with Moses and there were Ten Commandments and then you sort of move on. But I'm really, really looking at it. So what we're going to do in this class is place this subject in the big picture of God's work in the Bible, in the big picture of God's redemption. And I want us to look at how it functioned then. What was the law of Moses doing when it was given? But then what's its function now? And the real key to this, I think, the approach that I want us to take to this, and this is, I've left off part of the title of the class, and that is looking at the role of the law of Moses. Because it's not just, okay, what were their laws about sacrifices and their laws about the holy days and their laws about farming and animal care and things like that, which there are laws about those things. I want us to focus on the big picture. What was the law doing? What was it doing then? What does it do now? Because it's literally still in our Bibles. And we'll explore these more later, but remember what Jesus said in his Sermon on the Mount. Sermon on the Mount, where was the law given? On a mount. He said, I came to, not to destroy the law and the prophets, but what? Fulfill. Which to understand Christ, you've got to understand the law of Moses. So that's what we're going to be focusing on, is the role of the law of Moses and how we should look at that, and we're going to start with the historical context of it. So, two things we're going to do tonight. We're going to look, first of all, at the idea of when the law appeared in the biblical narrative. At the place that it appeared, what's been going on and what was going on. And thus, what role did it have when it was implemented? So we've been sitting on in Genesis on Sunday morning class, and we've summarized how that chapters 1 through 11 are about the first humans and these very elementary kind of experiences that they have and things that they do. See, that's why I don't use PowerPoint. I lose these markers all the time. Use PowerPoint. And then recently we've shifted from Genesis 12 onward, talking about Abraham, and now we're getting into the Jacob, Esau, and Isaac, and now getting into the Jacob and Esau saga, is that we looked at the what we commonly call the patriarchs. We said that these are the people that are the fundamental Hebrews. These are the fundamental humans. These are the fundamental Hebrews. You know, we're talking about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, which we're going to spend a lot of extra time on even in the sermons in the next few weeks. And so the patriarchs is covered there in those chapters. Now, how did God interact with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Directly. Spoke to them directly. And especially over and over, what did he keep telling them?
Promises.
Right, the promises, including what? The land would be their people's one day. And I want you to think about that for a second. This really meshes all really well together, everything we've been doing. Here's a man who's going to have sons, a son, and then he's going to have a couple sons, and then they're going to have sons. How is this family going to take an entire land full of all these formidable city-states? How can a family take a land? This land belonged to people. There have been people living on it for centuries when Abraham first migrated to Canaan. How is a family going to end up in control of this piece of land? Well, it's not going to be a family that takes it. It's going to be a nation that came from a family. See? Now, can a nation take a land? Yeah. We understand how that works, right? So, anyway. So, he spoke to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Made these promises. I'll make your name great to Abraham. You'll have a large nation to come from you. Large people to come from you. All those different things. All the families of the earth will be blessed through their seed. Now, was God talking to anybody else in this period? I'm talking about Genesis 12 to 50, based on what we yes. have. Okay, examples.
Abimelech,
the king, yep.
Job.
Okay, Job, okay. Not in Genesis 12 to 50, but the same time.
Melchizedek.
Okay. Hagar. You would think Melchizedek. We don't know that.
Hagar,
very good. And Sunday, in the class, Rebecca, about the children, okay? All right, directly to them, okay? And then there's another way besides directly speaking to them that he also communicated with that real hero of the latter chapters of Genesis, Joseph and how did he get understanding from
dreams.
God? Dreams. Either he had dreams or he had interpretation of dreams. God helped him to have that. So God's directly communicating those people. He's really directly communicating to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob on a regular basis. But he's talking to them in those ways. Okay? Did other people know what was happening regarding what Abraham and Isaac and Jacob was being told? For instance, let's just go back to Sunday's class and Abraham's servant that went to find a wife for Isaac. Do you remember when he was brought into Rebekah's home and her father and mother and her brother were there? And before he does anything, he wants to state his business, remember? And he tells them what?
Who he is.
Sorry, what?
Who he is and who
he is and who had sent him. And what had happened to Abraham. How that he'd become great and prosperous. And when he's describing it, if you want to note, it's Genesis chapter 24, 34, and 35. He says, the Lord has given him. This servant knew that Abraham's greatness and prosperity was from the Lord, which the Lord had promised that to Abraham. And that servant understood it. So we would understand that there are going to be people in their circle who are going to understand what God's communicating. For instance, if you want to look at this, Genesis 49, 28 to 33, glance at that. This is Jacob at the end of his life. His family's already migrated to Egypt because of the famine. Joseph is down there. And he issues all these prophecies about his sons. And then in chapter 49, 29 to 33, last thing we have from Jacob on his deathbed is what? What is he talking about? What does he want? Where he wants to be buried. Where does he want to be buried? That's right. The ancestral tomb that Abraham had purchased, the cave at Machpelah, and he had buried Sarah there. Abraham was buried there. Isaac is buried there. I think Rebekah is buried there. And Jacob and Leah were buried there. And so all these patriarchs were buried there. Why? Why does Jacob want to be taken all the way back there? What's the big deal about that place?
That's the land that was promised to him.
I mean, we could say his family's buried there. It's a family burial plot. You could say that. But we understand this goes deeper, don't we? You can't read Genesis 12 to 50 without saying this land and that burial plot goes deeper than that's the only place we own where we can bury our dead. He's down in Egypt. Joseph can give him the pick of a burial spot, right, in Egypt. But you see, this family's tied to that land. And so Jacob is making sure his family understands their history. And their history has been prophesied and has been brought about by God. Yeah, Joe? Joseph too. All right. Tied to that land again. Tied to that burial plot. So, even those around them understood what was going on because God had communicated to them. And this worked because this was a tight-knit family. It was not always a functioning family properly. Sometimes it was a train wreck of a family. But it was a tight-knit family. Even with the sibling rivalry that was present, it was a tight-knit family. You know, don't mess with their sister. Okay? Don't mess with them. And so, but I want to ask you this. How much instruction was given, if God's speaking to them directly, how much instruction is given to them about morality? Don't know. We do this. How much instruction is given to them about worship? We see them practicing sacrifices, building an altar and sacrificing. Abraham does it. Jacob does it. But we have no record of any instructions about that. We do know that Joseph had a heightened sense of morality, and thus he rebuffed Potiphar's wife's advances. But you know, not messing with the boss's wife, a lot of people know that rule. Okay? Yeah.
But then again, Pharaoh and Abimelech, they were aware
of the morality of the husband-wife relationship. That's right. That's exactly right. Another evidence that humans in general seem to have gotten that point, which they still do today, you know. You know, if you go up to somebody and say, who were you with the other day? Well, that was my neighbor's wife. The average person would go, whoa. Okay? I mean, that's just how it is still. It's just sort of human, you know, universal human kind of thing. But God's directly communicating to them. They're sharing it with people around them. But this is a tight-knit family. 400 plus years pass. We come to Exodus 1. Go to Exodus 1. Look at verse 7. What is the first thing we're told about the Israelites now, 400 years later, in Egyptian bondage? They have multiplied. They have grown, become strong, and multiplied. No surprise, right? Genesis 12:2, the beginning of this chapter of biblical history of the patriarchs. God told Abraham, I'll make of you a what kind of nation?
Great.
A great nation. And great there doesn't mean like glorious and powerful. Great means large. God says, I'll make of you a great nation. We finally see that the Israelite family has become a great nation. When we open up Exodus chapter 1, they have multiplied. They are just sprawling everywhere. It's an interesting term, nation, here in Genesis chapter 12, verse 2. And it's the common word for nation in our English Old Testaments. And when we think of nation, we think of an organized political system, an organized political body, which is the modern definition of the term nation. But English translators, this is the best they could do, is come up with a word that's close to this, but that's not really what the word means in the Old Testament, not even in the New Testament. The word in the New Testament means like ethnic group, okay? The word for nation. This one in the Old Testament literally means a troop of animals or a flight of locusts. If you think about when the Egyptian elite looked out over Egypt and saw the Hebrews, they appeared to be a swarm of locusts, didn't they? And so, nation there means a horde that's collected, that have something in common, okay? So when Exodus opens up, they are this big bunch of people right there in Egypt. But they're not organized into a political system like you and I would think of. Well, the whole point of the book of Exodus is that the Israelites, what's going to happen to them in Exodus? They're already in bondage. Yeah, we get there, and now the what?
They're going to get organized.
They're going to be freed. They're going to be freed. Okay. There's two responses when you get your freedom. One is, I'm free. The other one is, what now? Best estimates, there are about 2 million people, the Hebrews, when they leave Egypt. How are they going to function? Well, I suppose just like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, God can just speak to a few heads of the fathers directly, and they can just share it with their family members. How's that going to work with 2 million people? Not going to work very well, is it? Could God continue to communicate the way he did here? Or does he have to do something different? This is an entirely new chapter. This is a family. This is a race of people.
They're not supposed to intermarry.
They're to stay pure. That's right. Okay? And it's going to be in the law too. Okay? So, a new chapter is going to demand a new approach, including how God's going to interact with them. But there's more to that. Okay, let's go here to Exodus. Look in chapter 5. Moses has been sent back from Midian to lead them out. He's been sent to Pharaoh, he and Aaron. Okay, Jesse, can you read Exodus 5, verse 1?
Afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness.
Okay. That they may hold a feast to me. Now, do you think people then think the same thing when we think of feast? We think of feast as just purely a food event. A feast in biblical perspective would involve some kind of eating ritual, but it was bigger than that, wasn't it? It was something commemorative and something that was connected in worship to God. Even the pagans had feasts connected to their worship of the gods. Jesse, stay there. 7, flip over to 7, read verse 16. This is another occasion when Pharaoh's not letting them go and they go back in.
And you shall say to him, the Lord God of the Hebrews has sent me to you, saying, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. But indeed, until now, you would not hear.
Okay, Moses says they need to be released so they can go and do what? Serve God in the wilderness. We need to go serve God. Of course, you know, Pharaoh doesn't like that, right? Because what's in Pharaoh's eyes, these Hebrews exist for what purpose? To serve him. Okay. Zachary, look at chapter 8, verse 1. He goes back in later. Pharaoh keeps resisting. 8:1 says what?
Then the Lord said to Moses, go into Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go that they may serve me.
Do you see the emphasis here? Every time they're going in and saying, we're supposed to go out and do this for God. Now, Zachary, drop down the same chapter to verse 25. Read 25 to 27.
Then Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron and said, go, sacrifice to your God within the land. But Moses said, it would not be right to do so, for the offerings we shall sacrifice to the Lord our God are an abomination to the Egyptians. If we sacrifice offerings abominable to the Egyptians before their eyes, will they not stone us? We must go 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God as he tells us.
All right, we've seen feast. We've seen the generic idea of going and serving him. In this text, what were they supposed to go out and do?
Sacrifice.
There were a lot of different sacrifices practiced in ancient times. Now, here's the question. When you take 2 million people out in the middle of nowhere, and they're supposed to have a feast, they're supposed to serve the Lord, and they're supposed to offer sacrifices, then a very important question is, how are they going to do that? How are they going to go about that? Because we've had very limited communication here. And then we've had 400 years of no communication. How is that going to happen, rhetorically speaking, okay? They're going to need an approach. They're going to need some kind of order. It's not a bad word. They're going to need a system. They're going to need that. Because this is a whole new chapter now. And then I want you to flip over here to Exodus 19 when they get their freedom and they get to Sinai and God approaches them through Moses. And Rick, can you read Exodus 19, 5 and 6? Exodus 19, 5 and 6. This is the Israelites at Sinai and God approaching them through Moses.
Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel.
All right. He says, of all the people, I want you to be my people, is what he's saying. Of all the peoples, I'm going to make you my possession, which means my people. You're going to be a people. You're going to be a kingdom. You're going to be a nation. Okay? You're going to be a nation. Well, think about what that would involve. An approach, order, a system. They're going to need a law code. What I want you to see right off the bat tonight, because this subject is a challenging one and one that we tend to shy away from, I want you to see that there are other things equally, if maybe not more important, but I do want you to see that there is a practical dimension to this, that there is a functional element to the law. We look at Israel in so many ways and see it as such a failed thing, okay? But if they would have just gone out in the middle of nowhere, 2 million people, with no system, no code, no law, can you imagine how that would have gone? What?
Anarchy.
That's what you call anarchy. Exactly right. And when he gives them this law code, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about what he gave them, but I want you to look at how he gave it to them. He's using Moses as the communicator, the link. But look in Exodus 24. Exodus 24. Joe, can you read verse 4? First of all, this is after a lot of the law has been given and there's going to be a ceremony. 24:4.
Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then he arose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel.
Remember we read in Hebrews about Moses sprinkling the blood of the covenant? This is that ceremony. And one thing involved in this, before they actually sprinkle the blood, they sprinkle the blood on the people, and they also sprinkle it on something that Moses had created. He wrote down. Did you see that? It's actually called the Book of the Covenant later on. And then if that's not enough, look later in that chapter, Joe, read verse 12. What does God say in verse 12?
Now the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction.
All right. God did some writing. On what did he write? Tablets of stone. What are you doing when you etch something on stone and you put it down into a book? What are you doing?
You're making sure it stays.
That's right. This is a lasting thing, isn't it? This is a permanent mode of communication. Now, I mean permanent, not eternal. When Abraham died, he couldn't tell anybody what God was saying to him. When Isaac died, when Jacob died, that communication dried up, didn't it? The line went dead. Here is a new chapter, a whole big race of people. They've got something there to do. How are they going to do it? They've got to have a system. They've got to have a code. And this is not just given. Moses is this. Listen, the Bible presents Moses as being as close to God and communicating with God more than anybody outside the character of Jesus. But even Moses, in his important role of being this mediator and this lawgiver, the method on how the law was given, tablets of stone and written in a book, this is meant for all Israelites, all the time, of all time. You see that? And see how practical that is. It's a documented system. Comments, observations, questions?
It goes into chaos pretty quickly.
Pardon? What?
I mean, we actually see the anarchy happen before Moses gets back
even
down.
Even with the law code.
Before he gets back down the mountain, they're already going
right.
Crazy.
Right. It's not long after the law code comes that you start having problems. Okay. So.
The last 400 years, I mean, their law has been basically just do what Pharaoh says.
Right. They were under laws, but it was not God's. Right. People still break laws. But can you imagine our society without them? Good luck driving home tonight. Rick?
Yeah, and you made the point earlier that God really did not communicate any morality to these people. So we need to be careful about holding, you know, the Israelites and these people to the standards that we've known all of our lives and have been nations have been practicing for since it's been in existence.
And there is this interesting element that came out a while ago, and Joe was mentioning the people like Abimelech and Pharaoh. And I think Romans 1 is driving at this too, in Romans 1 and 2, that Gentile people knew some basic things of do's and don'ts, rights and wrongs, just like all people of all society. It's just almost baked in, isn't it, to the human experience. But there are a lot of other things that come up that need clarification and direction and warning that's on a moral level. And there is no evidence that they had been given any kind of extensive teaching on this. None. Except patriarchal wisdom handed generation to generation. But now this thing is a lot bigger than that. Yes, Becca.
I feel like in Job, though, that we see a lot of, like, they understand morality and they do get it. Maybe it's a little bit, they don't really understand fully, but they have things that they understand that God has given to them.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, Job's taking place in the Genesis period. A sense of justice. A sense of if you do wrong, you'll be punished. All those kinds of things. Of course, that was part of their problem, is the morality they were applying to that situation failed them, didn't it? Okay, so yeah, there is an awareness. But the rules are few and general. We'll put it that way. Yeah, Jesse?
Well, we've been talking about the anarchy that this nation will go on to face soon after this, with even with the law. But I think the Bible makes pretty clear when anarchy comes, it's usually because they're not doing what the law says.
Or even something he had just told them directly, like Moses or something, yeah. All right, and the golden calf was violation to the Ten Commandments. Yeah, that had already been given, right. Okay, all right, I wondered, I had more to cover, and I thought, but this is good. This is, you know, I'm pretty structured in my classes and my planning. This is sort of, I got a lot of different directions we can go with this, and that's on purpose. So I'm glad we're having this discussion. I feel like your wheels are turning, and that's great. That's what we want to do. So see you next Wednesday on this. Thank you.